Well, brewing with yeast, you know, usually we think about beer, usually we think about wine. What about biofuels? We're going to learn all about the connection today between biofuels and yeast from folks at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. A lot of very innovative research going on alternative energy sources at the center. Always happy to have an update from them and what they're working on. Usually, in fact, always, John Greenler comes by. John directs education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Great to have you back, John.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. He brought with him Chris Todd Hittinger, who is an assistant professor of genetics at UW-Madison, a researcher with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, recently won a National Science Foundation Faculty Early Career Development Award for his work on yeasts. And Chris, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Do you make your own beer?
I have tried, but it's best under the supervision of professionals who actually know what they're doing. On the other hand, we make poor quality beer every day in the lab by giving them sugar. And
okay, well, let's talk about yeast. What kind of an organism is yeast, and where do we find it in nature?
Well, the simplest definition of a yeast is that it's a one-celled fungus, but that sort of raises the question of what a fungus is.
Mm-hmm.
And so fungi are the sister kingdom to animals, and so they're actually a large group of organisms. Mushrooms are the ones that we encounter most often. And they are more closely related to us and other animals than they are to plants or bacteria. And so yeasts are fungi that have learned how to live as single cells instead of in the more complex mushroom structures. And frequently they're found in places where we find sugars. And so people frequently isolate them from fruit, sap, insects, flowers. And then also probably other places that we don't think of as often, such as inside people and animals, rotting logs.
Inside people and rotting logs, all in the same sentence.
Yeah. Anywhere they can make their living off of the free sugar. And so that's one of the central ways fungi differ from animals, is that we ingest our food and they digest it externally. They secrete special enzymes that break down food outside of the cell, and then they bring in their sugars into the cell to consume them.
Well, what's the history? We've got a human history connected with yeast that goes way the heck back,
back further than history itself. That's right. So people have been using yeast to make products for a very long time. And the big ones that people know of are, of course, wine, beer, and bread. And then in more recent times, biofuels. But there are a number of other products that people have also used yeast for. And so there are a number of things like fermented milks and sausages, cabbage, soy sauce. And indeed, people are now using yeast in some cases as probiotics or to make pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
So this is, as you say, a very long and fruitful history, if you pardon the pun.
Did you ever do any research on this, John, yourself? On the history of this?
A little bit of research, it goes back. We probably shouldn't talk too much about it.
All right. John Greenler and Chris Todd Hittinger, our guests today from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, talking about how we can tap into yeast for fermentation and actually maybe come up with some good biofuels through the use of yeast, and learning about that with them. What do you know about yeast and its use in biofuels? Probably not a lot. Maybe you have a question about it. Maybe you're a home brewer. What have you learned about yeast from your own experiences there? I'm pretty sure that we'll find out here that Chris and others have sort of piggybacked on a little bit on the backs of the beer producers and the wine producers on this. You may have a question or comment. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. All right. So what, you know, we've been producing yeast for fermentation for so long. How'd the idea come up for it as a biofuel?
Well, it's basically the same process used in the brewing and winemaking industry as it used in the biofuel industry. The idea is to take something like a simple sugar that yeast love to eat, let them chew on it for a little bit to make more yeast. And in the case of Saccharomyces, what they like to make is ethanol, which turns out to be a reasonably good fuel. Obviously, people are also working on advanced biofuels that would be longer chain hydrocarbons that would be more similar to gasoline. But the sort of low-hanging fruit is to simply take advantage of Saccharomyces' natural ability to make ethanol.
So Saccharomyces, that is the type of yeast that's...
That's right. So the main yeast that's used in brewing and winemaking is called Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which literally means sugar fungus of the beer. You just say it in Latin and then you sound scientific. But basically, that's exactly what it does in the brewing industry to make ales, is it takes the sugars that are coming from barley, and usually that's sugars called maltose and glucose, mm-hmm. And then it partially digests them and produces carbon dioxide and ethanol or alcohol.
Mark in Rockton has a question. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I understand that in the ethanol production process, somehow... the organic matter is treated with antibiotics at some juncture. I'm wondering if you can explain that to me and if there's any dangers from it in terms of it being in the residual feed that's fed to livestock, including our dairy cattle.
Yeah. Well, Chris, you know anything about it?
Generally speaking, we're talking about plant matter that in the biofuel industry that's used to produce a woody feedstock. And the industrial processes that break the sugar down into their sugars down into their individual components are pretty harsh, but I'm not aware of anybody actually using antibiotics on the plant material. Very few things would survive the chemical treatment process.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say something very similar. I think there's a very good chance that antibiotics might be being used to keep the yeast, you know, culture from being contaminated by bacteria. But once again, the processing that is downstream from that fermentation to produce either the ethanol for fuel or distillers' grains, you know, as Chris was saying, it's some pretty harsh industrial conditions that I think would probably break down any of those antibiotic compounds. It's also a situation where, kind of unlike using antibiotics in a feedstock, you know, type situation with, you know, with animals, that you've got very, very controlled contained conditions, and I'm sure it's very easy to monitor and regulate and control, you know, what's happening there. So, yeah, very interesting question.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll keep searching in case there's more out there.
All right. Thanks, Mark, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. So we've learned quite a bit from the beer and wine industry in terms of using yeast. I would, you know, that's a large scale. I mean, somebody like mm-hmm. Anheuser-Busch or Miller, I mean, we're talking a large scale.
Yeah, lager beer alone is $250 billion a year industry worldwide. And so it's obviously a major economic player in Wisconsin and the United States and the world as a whole.
And so we've learned a lot from them in terms of how we can make biofuels on a large scale.
Well, so one of the things that I think we've learned in particular that's the impetus for our involvement in GLBRC, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, is that some of the other species of yeast are actually playing an important role in the brewing industry. And that's been a surprise that's really come out of the ability to do modern genetic analyses in the last 10 years or so. And so what we're starting to learn is that one species, that one group of yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, in some cases, in the brewing industry, is actually being used in a hybrid form where it's actually been unknowing to brewers, crossed by to another naturally occurring yeast species. And then that hybrid is actually having new properties that the original yeast did not have. And so we're now trying to start to take advantage of this ability to make strains in the laboratory that cross natural mm-hmm. variants that we get out of the soil and out of sap and bark mm-hmm. To strains that are already very well adapted to high sugar fermentation processes, and try to get some of the natural tolerance alleles that they have from being able to survive in nature to get the best of both that along with fermentation.
Yeah, right. Both worlds. Yeah. Rod in Sun Prairie, hello. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm a home winemaker, and I do believe that glycerin is one of the byproducts of fermentation and a lot of other things, too. And I'm wondering if this is something that the ethanol plants can produce and then sell? And what can you tell me about the glycerin and the byproduct of fermentation?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So when glycerin is produced, it's sometimes called glycerol. It's produced actually instead of ethanol. And so when you take sugar, some yeasts prefer to take a small fraction of the carbon and kick it off to glycerol instead of ethanol. And this is important in the wine industry because it contributes to what winemakers call mouthfeel.
Yep,
it cuts down the astringency and enhances some of the flavor properties. And one of the interesting things that people have learned in the last couple of years is a lot of the strains that produce some of the most glycerol are actually hybrids of Cerevisiae wine yeasts and another species called Cudriavzevii. And this particular species likes to produce a lot of glycerol, especially in the cold. And so I couldn't have planted the caller better. This is another case where a particularly commercially desirable property is actually taking advantage of the natural fermentation capabilities of Cerevisiae and bringing in genes from another species in order to perform more desirable fashion.
Are Wisconsin ethanol plants enjoying some of this business? Do they do that?
almost all of the commercial biofuel producers are currently using Cerevisiae, often genetically engineered strains, but generally speaking, not hybrids.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. These are already being used in the industry.
That's correct. And so that's been a focus of our research in the last couple of years, actually, is to look at what people are using and maybe didn't realize they were using. And so the other big discovery is that lager yeast, which is the cold temperature beer that we associate with the crisp flavors of the big brewers like Miller and Budweiser, light lagers are brewed in the cold. And it turns out that Cerevisiae does very badly brewing at cold temperature. And by hybridizing with the species that we recently discovered with Dr. Diego Lipkind in Argentina, lager producers have been able to produce a very cold brewed beer. And part of this is because Patagonia is very cold. It has a climate similar to Wisconsin. And it turns out that this species called Eubaeanus actually ferments perfectly happy at freezing. And so this is a perfect candidate to, if you want to brew in the cold, you take a Cerevisiae ale strain and hybridize it with Eubaeanus.
Patagonia. You're working with Patagonia.
That's correct. So we have a good friend and collaborator, Dr. Diego Lipkind, who works for their National Science Foundation, which is called CONICET down there. And he collects strains, and we sequence the genomes and look at what they're contributing to industrial processes and what they're doing in the wild.
Very cool. We're talking, we're from beer to biofuels, really, here, tapping into the biodiversity and evolution of yeast for fermentation, with a couple of people from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, John Greenler and Chris Todd Hittinger. Great to have them along. They'll be with us right up until 12:30. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Wisconsin is an innovator in many areas, and certainly alternative energy, no exception to that. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. There are many brilliant folks working on sources of energy. They're building on the knowledge of other industries to advance alternative fuels as fast as possible. We have a couple of people with us today in the studio who are working on those kinds of things. Chris Todd Hittinger assistant professor of genetics at UW-Madison, researcher with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, recently won a National Science Foundation faculty early career development grant for his work on yeast. Chris, thanks again for being with us. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure to talk about yeast.
And John Greenler directs the education for both the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And John, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So we're talking about their work on tapping into the biodiversity and evolution of yeast for fermentation and making biofuels with yeast as a prime mover here, and sort of taking some information learned from the beer and the wine industries and applying it to biofuels. So it's great to have them along. Again, you can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. George in Sussex been waiting a while, so let's go there. George, hi. Thank you for waiting.
How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, well, my question is, what kind of yeast can you get off of trees, and what use would it have in the, you know, this day and age?
So trees are one of the principal places that we actually isolate yeast, including Saccharomyces and also many other more distantly related groups of yeast. And so I would say that that's a major substrate. They're probably, in some cases, living off of the sugars that are produced by the sap. In other cases, they're being dropped off by insects. And a lot of fungi, and yeasts included, have pretty close relationships, actually, with the plants that they grow on. And so this is probably important because in the biofuel industry, one of the major foci is to take the woody plant material, treat it with harsh chemicals to get out the sugars, but you also end up getting out a lot of poisons that are coming from the lignin, the really hard woody parts. And so this is, of course, a substrate that yeasts are interacting with in nature, and so they have a lot of different genetic ways of coping with that, and we're hoping to start to take advantage of that using yeasts from nature.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, George, for calling. Appreciate the call. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Facebook comment from Buzz, who says, when I'm brewing a 10-gallon batch of beer, I often divide it in half and add two different yeasts. When putting the typical American ale yeast in an IPA, one gets a very different beer than when Belgium ale yeast is used. And the only difference is the yeast. You get quite a different beers.
That's exactly right, Buzz. In fact, we've replicated that experiment in collaboration with a brewer friend. It turns out that one of the genetic findings is that a lot of these Belgian strains are actually hybrids of Cerevisiae and Kudrievzeviae. And Kudrievzeviae, in some cases, is probably responsible for some of the spicy notes and the esters that you're getting in some of these Belgian beers. Now, we don't know what the genetic basis of that is yet, but frequently that's what's probably being observed, is that this is another case where some of those unique traits that people are observing are, again, coming from non-Cerevisiae Saccharomyces. Hmm.
So you received, and I mentioned this, National Science Foundation Early Career Award, and what's the research related to this award? Is it
So that particular grant sort of has two planks. One of them is the research plank that focuses on following up of our recent discovery of Saccharomyces eubaeanus, which is this species we discovered in Patagonia that hybridized with Cerevisiae ale yeast to create lager yeast, which, you know, has then become this $250 billion a year industry. And so we're trying to understand what the natural diversity is of eubaeanus. And so we have a very large strain collection with our collaborator down in Patagonia, Dr. Libkind. And so we're looking at its genetics. It turns out to be extremely diverse. And so now we're trying to understand which versions of the genes ultimately ended up into the industrial process and whether there might be some additional diversity that's out there. And we're also trying to understand what's going on in the Patagonian ecosystem, because it turns out that there's a lot of closely related lineages and populations that are presumably interacting with one another in nature and partitioning out resources, but we don't understand how that's happening yet. And that's a very interesting evolutionary question.
I wanted to bring up something that you've got going, which is a citizen science program. It's a wild yeast Citizen Science Program. Talk about that.
Yeah, so this is the other major part of our career grant from the National Science Foundation. And so the Wild Yeast Program is an acronym. YEAST stands for the Yeast Exploration and Analysis Science Team. And so this, the backbone of this are undergraduate researchers right here at UW-Madison and also visiting high school students. And in particular right now, Kayla Sylvester and Russell Mendez are doing the lion's share of the work, and they isolate yeast from around Wisconsin. And anybody can participate in this because we accept soil samples from around the state and around the country. Not from overseas because of customs regulations, but certainly if you're interested in participating, you can go to hittinger.genetics.wisc.edu. And since my name is unpronounceable and unspellable, I think there's probably a link on the website.
Yeah, if you can go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, you can get a link to Chris's site, which really sounds like a lot of fun. So what are people doing? Do they go out and dig up a...
Yeah, so it's, as we've mentioned, yeast are found on all seven continents, and they're found just about anywhere you can think to look. And so it's the easiest sample to collect are usually soil samples. And so all you have to do is go to a local forest or park and get just a little bit of soil and put it in a more or less clean container. And there's instructions about what recommendations we would make. Sandwich bags are excellent. And then if it's packed into a labeled and packed into an envelope, and if you fill out the form and tell us where it came from, then that allows us to know which species are coming from where.
Oh, that sounds so cool. How much do you need?
Not very much at all. So probably considerably less than you think. Remember, these are microscopic organisms. These are single cells. So if you have just a very little bit of dirt, you know, as much as your thumb, there are probably millions of yeast there. And what happens is we take that dirt, and then researchers in the lab make a solution full of sugar and other nutrients that yeast like, and then we add antibiotic because most of the microbes in there are bacteria, and so we need to kill off those. And then we let them go through a fermentation process, and then the students isolate them down to single cells, and those get frozen away in our freezer at about minus 150 degrees Fahrenheit, and they will stay there forever to support bioenergy research and other questions in basic biology.
So you thaw them out eventually, and...
That's right. So once we have them, we take them and look at their DNA. And so there's what taxonomists call a DNA barcode. And so this is a particular gene that all organisms share. And people have sequenced this gene from multiple organisms. And so all we have to do is determine the A, T, G, C, the basic code of life for that particular segment. And then we can use a computer program to compare that to the database that researchers around the world have built up over the years. And this allows us to identify what you've collected and what we've been able to isolate, and then in some cases determine that it's indeed new to science. And both of those results are exciting because if it's new to science, that's obviously an important discovery. And if it's actually something we already have, there's a pretty good chance that we don't have it from where you're at. And even if it's the same species, as you know, humans are quite different from one another. And even within a species of yeast, they're quite different from one another.
Have you thought about working with the Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory at the UW? Because the Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory gets soil samples from all over the state, and they're very identified by location very well. And if you don't need a lot, you could probably...
That's a great idea, Larry. I think we should look into that. And especially one of the nice things about that would be that they would have additional data on the chemical content of soil.
I think you should do that. You
should be a scientist, Larry.
I do research, but it's communications research, so it's a little different from what you're doing. So actually, there are other soil testing labs that are private labs, too, that probably would cooperate with you. Well, we had a Facebook question from Ruth Ann. What's the difference between bread yeast and wine or beer yeast?
So generally speaking, in each of those cases it's Saravicia, except for some of the specialist wine and brewing products that we've mentioned where it's hybrids. But most of those are species of Saravicia. And I think probably the best way to think of this is if you think about the dogs, we all recognize them as dogs. They're a member of the same species, but there are different breeds of dogs. And so there are some yeasts that are better at making wine and some that are better at making beer or different kinds of beer. And there are also some that are better at making breads. And in some cases, we actually know what it is to be a good bread yeast. You have to be able to break down some of the oligosaccharides or medium chains of sugar that are present in bread, but not as frequently present in wine. And in other cases, it's still an active research question, what makes a strain good at one process and not the other.
Hmm. How in the world did you get interested in yeast?
Well, so I'm actually interested in basic questions about how organisms vary from one another and how their genetics changes over time. And so that's really my passion is as a basic geneticist. And it turns out that Saccharomyces cerevisiae is really one of the champion models of basic biomedical research. And so there's about five or six organisms that basically have contributed to almost all that we know about the way molecular genetic processes work. And Saccharomyces cerevisiae is one of those organisms. And there have been critical discoveries in biochemistry, cancer biology, and molecular genetics in this organism. So it's a very fundamental model system for a variety of questions. Mm-hmm. What's been missing from that model system is the evolutionary perspective, and that's because so little has been known about yeast diversity more broadly in terms of how many species of Saccharomyces there are, how they're related to one another. And so we're trying to address that head on so that we can start to use some of the comparative approaches that are available in other traditional evolutionary genetic systems.
Yeah. And there are thousands, do you think? Or?
So there are currently over 1,500 described species of yeasts, and there are probably thousands more, as you say. Now, of the relatives of Saravicia, the close relatives that are in the same genus, there are only seven. But there are a number of other more distantly related yeasts.
So just to get back to your research, because it's been a while since we've talked mm-hmm. about that, how are you using this research on yeast to maybe at one point come up with a great biofuel or to improve the biofuels that we or the process of making the biofuels?
That's right. So there are several things that these other yeasts have to contribute. One is that we know so little about them that any discoveries are potentially going to be useful in this area. And so the main possible areas that we're likely to make advances are the ability to tolerate some of the poisons that are being created by breaking down this complex woody plant material. Different temperature tolerances. We've already alluded to the cold temperature tolerance of some of the brewing strains that are being contributed by other species. Also, you can imagine higher temperature tolerance being useful in some cases. And the other areas are possible secondary metabolites or fine chemicals that can be produced. And along this line, there are some species of yeasts that, for example, make oils instead of ethanol. And obviously, that would be a more useful advanced biofuel. And so by understanding what other species of yeast are capable of, we hope to be able to learn from them and either re-engineer Saravicia or learn how to make modifications to these other mm-hmm. species in order to take what's useful about Saravicia and its ability to break down sugars to maybe make other higher value chemicals or fuels.
So this is basic kind of research, isn't it?
Yeah, it really very much fits into the kind of portfolio of work that GLBRC is about. I mean, we're really, you know, fundamentally trying to make the basic research happens that it will allow us to really, you know, make some quantum leaps forward, in terms of bioenergy and more specifically these liquid transportation fuels. And so this is really a critical juncture, being able to get from these sugars or polymers made out of sugars to various fuels, whether, as Chris was saying, whether it be ethanol or fuels that would be direct replacements, drop-in replacements for diesel or gasoline. So, yeah, and once again, you know, the clearly we've got a pretty good handle on how to use yeast to make ethanol from corn grain.
Right.
And we're really interested in getting away from that and moving forward, once again, using, you know, we've talked a lot about these cellulosic type materials, these fibrous plant materials that, you know, would represent, you know, woody material, which could be residue from forestry or it could be residue from our corn agriculture, what we call corn stover. After you take the grain, you have the stem and the leaves and the cobs that remain. You know, how can we come up with yeast that would be able to work within that context? Switchgrass, a perennial grass, is another, you know, good example of that. So these are some, you know, very novel type conditions that we're, you know, putting to these yeast. And as, you know, as Chris is saying, we have these toxins or inhibitors, which are breakdown products from these cellulosic, you know, materials. And, you know, the traditional yeast strains aren't used to seeing that. And clearly looking to nature, you know, for strains that might, you know, be better there. And the other thing that which I think is really interesting, we've been talking a little bit about evolution, but, you know, just to go a little bit further with that, too, is the ability in the laboratory to essentially do directed evolution, to take a yeast strain that shows some potential and essentially to kind of try and evolve that strain to do even better, you know, is really critical. We want to set the stage as best as possible. So what's out there in nature that we can bring to the stage, and then how do we move from there? So it's all part of this research pipeline, trying to put all the pieces together to sustainably produce these next generation fuels.
Yeah. As I think about the research that has gone on at GLBRC, there have probably been a lot of unintended consequences, probably not the right.
Sure.
But there have been probably been some discoveries that were totally unrelated to what you were originally thinking about.
You know, it's interesting that you raise it up, because actually I'm working with an undergraduate this summer who's working in a lab, our experimental fermentation lab, which essentially is kind of, we were talking about that pipeline, is the next step from Chris's research.
Yeah.
And she was telling a great story just yesterday about how she was in the middle of an experiment. They had a fermentation going with some strains of yeast, and I think it was Saturday night. The power went down just for a little bit of time, and then it went back up. But all of her instrumentation that was controlling the experiment went haywire, and some things really changed. The pH, for example, really became dramatically different than what she had programmed into her experiment, essentially. And they came in the next morning and discovered that things were kind of wacko. And initially they were really worried, but then they thought, well, let's take a look at the results and see what happened. And ended up actually they got some yields that were higher than expected. And they're now really busy trying to figure out, you know, what had happened when the power went down, and can they replicate that to try and get these higher yields? So she's really sitting on a bit of a gold mine that really was a bit of scientific serendipity.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Well, you, John, you're with the GLBRC, and you're with the Wisconsin Energy Institute as well. So GLBRC and WEI.
Mm-hmm.
What goes on at each one? Let's talk about that for a minute.
Sure. So the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center is multi-institutional to start out with. So, you know, there's two major partners, UW-Madison and Michigan State University, but then we have a number of other collaborating institutions. There's the numbers changed a little bit with some regularity, but I think, you know, we have around 10 different partners at this point in time. And, you know, we're very diversified in terms of our disciplines, from molecular biologists to economists, ecologists, computer modelers, trying to put all the different perspectives together to really come up with a very large-scale solution, largely for liquid transportation fuels. So very, very exciting. But once again, a national effort, about 400 you know, researchers and staff that are involved. The Wisconsin Energy Institute, we opened our doors in February here on the UW-Madison campus. And we're really trying to facilitate and inspire new sustainable energy, largely research here on the UW-Madison campus. We have collaborators off campus as well, but you know, clearly there's been extraordinary energy research, which has been going on here on the Madison campus for many years. But we're trying to create new opportunities for communication and collaboration between what initially might seem like some very disparate areas. So, you know, we range from, setting up and considerations of microgrids, electrical grid systems that would be functioning within our more regional and national grids, to, you know, more biofuels research, solar power, policy concerns. So once again, very wide ranging, but we really have a focus of bringing together all of the great work that's being done here in Wisconsin to address national and really international issues.
Yeah, and that's a great thing to do. I think it's just too often we the tendency is always to just work with within your own little group.
Yes,
and Chris, you probably had that as well. It's really and very inspiring, frankly, to get out and work with people who aren't in your particular discipline, and a lot can be learned. I know a lot can be learned. So, and with that, here we are out of time. I really appreciate you guys taking time to be with us today. Again, I want to go back to Chris Todd Hettinger's Wild Yeast Citizen Science Program. If you want to get involved in that Citizen Science Program, you can go to his site. Actually, just go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you can click on and figure out how to give him some yeast. Give him a little soil and get him some yeast. Maybe you'll give him some yeast that he has never seen or heard of before. You never know. Chris Hettinger is with the GLBRC at the University of Wisconsin in the Department of Genetics. John Greenler directs education for the GLBRC and the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Thank you all for listening. We'll talk about wine, as a matter of fact, tomorrow at 11 on the IdeasNet. Stay with us. Appreciate you listening.